What I'm getting at here is that for the churches, and this is going to be true for the Jewish community, probably more so in some ways than for the Protestant and the Catholic communities, these were issues which couldn't be avoided, couldn't be delayed. You couldn't send these back to committee. You would have to take stands on these things, you know, here and now. And you, therefore, when these major issues came, the consensus that we had had during World War II and during the Cold War simply disappeared. There's no way you could hold the country together again over these things. Churches divided over the peace movement, they divided over all of the movements. We had the beginnings, for instance, in some of the churches, of ordination of women, and that helped divide the churches. Or all kinds of other things that came along. All right. My point is that the old-time religion, that which said that there was always right and wrong and good and evil and true and false and all these things, disappeared. And disappeared rather quickly, and it's so fun to, not fun, but sad to think of what would happen to the old-time religion today. There are only a couple of, places that hold to the old-time religion today. One would be our good friends, Missouri Synod, Lutheran Church, who put such a strong emphasis on pure doctrine, and Wisconsin Synod too, for that matter. Some elements in Walt Disney, I'm getting to Walt Disney, in Southern Baptist. Maybe you saw this thing that the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination, officially told us people not to fraternize or patronize any Walt Disney products because they found some latent homosexual themes, wasn't that it? Mm-hmm. I think they found in there and so on. And that's sort of an element of the old time religion. That's what I'm trying to suggest. But the new time religion really prevails. Okay, that's just enough background summarized very quickly, and it's on tape if any of you want to do it. But mostly what happened is some of you have been there. I wind up, once you start laughing at my jokes, I can't quit. That's the worst thing you can do is start laughing at them. Here I go with one. I was giving a chapel talk, and that was all in the morning at school. And chapel ends at a certain time, but I started telling a couple jokes, and two or three of my friends started laughing, and I got totally carried away. And all of a sudden, when the bell rang at 10:30, namely chapel was over, I looked down and I still had three pages to go, on my talk, because I had timed it for 12 minutes. That's what you're supposed to do for chapel, and I had 3 minutes, and I said doxology, and that was the closing hymn, and never did get in those last three. So maybe I should tend to what we're supposed to be talking about here and see what happens. Okay, now. To start with this one, many of the elements which help change, the Jewish old-time religion to the new-time religion, and some of it isn't obviously changed, as we'll talk about with the Orthodox here, especially showed up from the period of 1945 really to the present. But to understand the Jewish situation, we have to sort of go back, I think, a little bit further. The problem here with the Jewish old-time, the new-time religion is this. Since all Jews in this country, or all Jews around the world, agree, that there is such a thing as the Jewish tradition, as the Jewish faith. And the Jewish religion has all the commodities, I should say, or the elements of a religion. To have an organized religion, you need to have four things, the things I have on the board here. You need to have a community, which is Israel, or the Promised Land, or whatever you want to call it. There's a leader, namely Moses. There's the book, the Torah, the first five books. And then we'll add the Talmud that comes along later to all the other laws and rules that came, but the first five books are basically it for this. And you have a place, so you have Jerusalem. If you stop to think of it, you could say the same thing for the Catholics. You could say the same things for the Mormons. Jesus called God. And said, no, what was it? Jesus called President Clinton, that's what it was. Jesus called President Clinton, he said, there's good news and there's bad news. And Clinton said, what's the good news? And Jesus says, I'm back on earth. And Clinton said, what's the bad news? He said, I'm in Salt Lake City. and they have their place. And it was, to me, it was marvelous. I teach American history. This wonderful pilgrimage, they had these people, it was their 150th anniversary this year. And they just laid down everything, and they got the old clothes, the food, the transportation, and all the rest of this, and they took the pilgrimage. Something like 3.5 or 4 months that it took them, and they had breakdowns and all the rest of the things. An incredibly interesting group, and a purely an American group. That's what's so, I think, interesting about the Mormons, as it was born and nurtured in this country, whereas almost all the other religions came from overseas. Okay, to come to the Jewish thing here, they have the four elements for a religion. Okay, then the question becomes, why the turmoil? Why is there so much difficulty, not only between, say, Jew and Arab, which we'll be talking about a little bit, and I'd like to talk about that, and I invite your comments as we go But why should there be so much turmoil within Judaism itself today? Why can't they agree on, you know, their past? Why can't they agree on what's expected of them, you know, here and now? Because you'll see the three groups I have on the board there, and you can find little, you know, refinements of these and shadings and nuances. But basically, the Jewish community in the United States and around the world is divided into these three camps up here. You see the Reform group, you see the Conservative, and you see the Orthodox. And there is very, very little what you'd call constructive communication or cooperation, you know, between these groups. They are very, very suspicious and leery of one another, and that it reflects the idea that the old-time religion, to stay with the theme we're supposed to be talking about here, it reflects the theme that the old-time religion is having a great deal of difficulty surviving, you know, in the present. Not only in this country, but surviving, you know, in Israel and around the world. Okay. So what we want to talk about then, how did this come about? This rather sharp, not rather, this very severely sharp division that you find here, and also what might the future be? Because the way I look at it, and if we want to talk about what's happening between Jew and Arab now, we can do this. It's the one place where I really don't see, you know, any kind of satisfactory, you know, or peaceful solution. I really don't think that I can't see how this is going to happen. Every so often things will go along and they'll have the peace process and, you know, Netanyahu and Arafat will get together and they'll have their picture taken and do all these things. And all of a sudden some crazy will come in a suicide bombing or something, and then it'll all go up in smoke again, and then it'll set in and go on again. In a way, I suppose the same thing you could say is true for Northern Ireland. I suppose it's the same. The IRA there is in that kind of situation. And in a way, what's fascinating, and it's grim, is that these are not just political battles, these are not just, you know, economic struggles, but these are religious battles. And I think more than in any of the other denominations in this country, the old-time religion has divided, you know, the Jewish groups into more, what should I say, competing and hostile elements than in any of the other major religions. I'm talking about the Protestant, we talked about, you know, mainstream and evangelical, and then the Catholics. Okay. So the issues really are theological. The issues aren't just over money or over education, over rich versus poor, or education versus lesser education, or ethnic kind of conflicts or racial conflicts. You don't find that the way you would find, for instance, say in Africa or somewhere else like that. But they are religious, okay. And therefore, the issue, I think, is really, in a sense, a stalemate, because nobody, in a way, it's like the Catholics we were talking about yesterday, nobody on any side in the issues, which we're going to get to here, can back down, because each of them claim to be sort of the possessor, you know, of God's will. How can you compromise with what God has told you you have to do? You can't do that very well, obviously, and still claim that you have the, you know, you have the direct pipeline to God. There's no sort of compromise. Does that make any sense, what I'm trying to say? Okay, I think that's important. In a way, we were talking about this yesterday with the Catholics. My own prediction there is that I think eventually the Catholic Church will ordain married men, and that I think celibacy will no longer be a requirement for the priesthood. But I don't see any way in which they can ever compromise on not ordaining women. I think you can make some theological, you know, statements about ordaining or getting rid of celibacy, but not women, not for the next, you know, what, 100 years, or who knows what's going to happen after that. And then, of course, there are some people who think we aren't even going to get to, we're not even going to get to 2000. And we could talk about that, and I've got a good joke there, but I'll save that one for later. Okay, anyway, the millennium sort of thing is what I'm talking about. So the question then is, who has sort of the final pipeline to God? What is the true will, you know, of Jehovah or Yahweh, if you like the Old Testament word, for people, you know, in 1997? And why can't people sort of come to terms with it? That's where I want to go with this, because there are those who argue that the old time, that especially the Orthodox, with a capital O, the Orthodox argue you have to preserve the old time religion. It can't change. The Messiah won't come until you do. And others say, you know, Judaism is a living religion. You have to come to terms with where it is in the world. You have to accept the fact that there have been certain major changes, as we'll see in Jewish history, which have made this difference, and that therefore the world of 1997 is not the world of, you know, 4000 BC, when you had, you know, the Orthodox in total control, and you had no obvious you know, differences within the church itself. Okay, so we start with the premise really that the Jewish community is trying to come to terms with holding on to the old time religion, or trying to find ways in which they can still stay true to the loyalties of their tradition and still stay, you know, modern, and still live in the modern world itself. Okay. Does that, I just want to be sure, because what I'm going to do now is, if you, maybe most of you wouldn't know at your age, you wouldn't know Paul Harvey, the radio commentator, and Paul Harvey would say, now for page two, and I do that for my elder hostels. Some of you know I do elder hostels all the time, and they, you know, the seniors, they just love Paul Harvey, and then when I tell them I live in Phoenix in the wintertime, and because Paul Harvey's down there, still going strong, this guy, he certainly doesn't need the money. I think he owns Camelback Mountain or something down there, and everything else, but it is page two, so we'll make that transition. Got a beautiful voice, but his politics are, you know, 13th century or something, as far as I can tell. All right, anyway, page two with us. Now, it's important in America, we're talking about the Jewish community in America, that's the theme here, to know that although the first, you know, permanent white settlers came to this country in 1607, namely at Jamestown, the Jewish people were first here in 1642. That's important to keep in mind. They were here, they came to Newport, Rhode Island, because Roger Williams had created, not the piano player, you know, but Roger Williams had created an atmosphere of religious tolerance and acceptance and all the rest, and some of the Jewish people who already knew the anti-Semitism, which we'll be talking about, understood this and came there, and this helps the claim of some Jewish groups, especially the Reform group, which is the more, I suppose you could call, liberal group here, that you can be a Jew and you can be just as good a Jew in America as you can be anywhere else. It doesn't matter. You don't have to live in the Holy Land. You don't have to live in Israel. And they'll say, look, we've been here, you know, much longer than many of the other immigrant groups. It took us Norwegians a little while to even know about America, and we don't get any Norwegians, which of course I am one of. You don't get any of those here until the 1820s. It took them a little longer, but the Jews were here, you know, 180 years before. And that's a joke, but anyway, nobody laughs, so we'll go ahead with this one. All right. Anyway, that's important, because there are those who claim that the only homeland, you know, should be Israel. And that therefore, unless you live in Israel and try to preserve the old-time religion, you're not a good Jew. That's so important. And other people say, look, our credentials are in order. We've been here for a long time. We're well established. You know, we go to temple. We keep kosher. We do all the other things. We observe the high holy days. We send our kids to yeshiva, the Jewish schools and everything. Who's to say that we aren't good Jews? Okay. The battle starts really, you know, I think a sense there. Now, today, just to jump up with this sort of thing, although the first Jews came in 1642, if you're ever in Newport, be sure, Rhode Island, they have restored the original synagogue, and it's, I like restored places, but that is a beautiful place, and that really is worth, you know, whatever your background, that really is worth going to. That's the restored Jewish synagogue, and it's a remarkable place. You probably won't see anything quite like that anywhere else. All right. Now, to leap up to the present here, what's happened is that with that first introduction, the number of Jewish people who have come to this country has, you know, increased enormously. And as far as we can tell, and I'm drawing here from New York Times statistics in 1994 here, altogether within this country, you know, adults, that is, you know, women, men and children, there are approximately 8.2 million Jews in this country out of a total population of about, what is it now, about 262 million. Million or something else like that. Maybe you've seen that. Maybe you've been in Washington and you've seen that counter on the U.S. Department of Commerce thing that shows how many people are being born all the time. They never show how many people are dying all the time over another one. But I think it's about 262 million. Okay, that are here now. Of that 262, 8.2 are Jewish. All right. Of that 8.2, among the adults, 5.5 million say they are, quote, religious. That is, they identify themselves specifically with the Jewish faith. These aren't the ones who have sort of gone over to being either totally secular or through intermarriage, which is one of their really big problems today, to another faith, but they still hold on in one way or another in one of these three groups here, which we'll be talking about, to the Jewish faith. So 5.5 million, all right. And over the years, and we'll briefly trace this, three major groupings have developed within the within the Jewish community. And I'll define them a little bit later, but it'd be the Orthodox, which is about 7% of the total Jewish population in this country, the Conservatives, which would be sort of in the middle of these groups, and then you see the 40.4 that I've got there, and the Conservative, the 40.4, and then the Reform, the more liberal, whatever other term you want to use, this would be 41%, and the others just sort of call themselves Other, in the New York Times review. All right. Now, what's so important really about this? What is significant here is that if you were to follow the religious developments of the Jewish community in the United States, you'd think that the capital Orthodox were far more numerous. And while they only have about 7% of the total population, that's because these are the ones who are the militants. These are the ones who live in clearly defined, very heavily, specialized ethnic communities. Williamsburg in Brooklyn, for instance, there's a larger Jewish daily newspaper in Williamsburg than there is in Jerusalem. I mean, in terms of total population. There are Jews who live in there, or the Lower East Side, if you know, in Manhattan, and we lived there for a while, and so I like to always talk about this, but there are Jews there that never get out of their community, that never even have to speak English, or even have to meet the Gentiles, or the Goyim, as they like to refer to us. That's a sort of a sarcastic term with this. I remember myself, I had a sabbatical at Union Seminary, and we were just two blocks away from Jewish Seminary, and I wasn't, wasn't ready for living this. This was 122nd and Broadway, and about the fourth day we were there, we went out to get some groceries, and most of the stores were closed. And we didn't realize it was High Holy Days, it wasn't just a little bit; it was a lot of places. Or I remember my two children were 6 and 4 at the time, and we used to like to take a little walk after dinner around the neighborhood, and sorted some of the Jewish scholars up at Jewish Seminary, which was right there at 122nd. And back in Northfield, Minnesota, my children, who are both blonde and blue-eyed, were sort of normal, run-of-the-mill. There really weren't a whole lot of blue-eyed blonde kids, up at 122nd and Broadway. So suddenly we had the realization that we're in a whole different cultural setting, a whole different kind of milieu, which is, for some people, says that it has to continue that way. Okay, what's so important, my point here, is that if you were to look at the press, you would think that the Orthodox population would be much, much larger, because these are the ones who are the aggressors. That's the only word for it. The militants. If the fanatics. I think that's true in some of these ones. These are the ones with the unique dress. The idea being that the Messiah will never come until the Jewish community is perfectly ready to accept and receive, that's a better word, to receive the Messiah, and therefore you have to hold to the old traditional time, if you want to call it old time Jewish faith, with no compromise whatsoever. When it comes sundown on Friday, you stop. I mean, they don't even, for instance, have cooking on the Sabbath, because they'll make enough, like soup or something else like this to see you through until sundown on the next day. But basically very, very strict. And so they are the ones also who've had, remember, what was it, about 10 years ago, they had some real racial conflicts in the area. I'm trying to think of the name of the community where that was in Brooklyn. And this is also true, obviously, in Israel. So that would account for the belief, I think, for a lot of people, that the Jewish community is made up largely of the very militant. They aren't, but they are the ones who get the publicity. And as when we get to Israel, we'll see they are the ones also who call the shots for the prime minister and for what's going on there. They know exactly what they're doing. I'm trying to, not Don Borisenko. Oh, what's his name, for goodness sake? He's an American, too, but he's the prime minister. Netanyahu, there we go. It's not a, the first time I heard it, I thought this isn't a Jewish name, but some of you might know he was born and he was raised and educated in this country. This is true, and this is an indication of this very strong thing we want to talk about, very strong, close relationship between Israel and this country. Golda Meir, some of you might remember, she was born and raised, she was a school teacher in Milwaukee. And look what happened to her, she becomes Prime Minister of Israel. And that very strong sort of thing I want to talk about. Okay, now, what I want to get into sort of page three here is what has given the Jewish community its unique, distinctive personality, and what difference does that make for the old time versus the new time religion? For some of you, this may be review, and I would just ask you to bear with me. Some of you might find this sort of interesting, and for some of you it might be sort of new material. So I'll try to find a happy medium here with what I'm trying to say. All right. Who was it once? There was a German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, was also a teacher, and he says, how do you pitch your material for your classes? You can't help, the very good students will take care of themselves. You can't help the poor ones, so what you do is sort of aim at the middle. And I think having had 38 years, I think that's about right. The good ones, you just get out of the way and show them the way to the library, and the poor ones, goodness, you just hope and pray and send them to the dean or to the counselors. And the others, that's where you aim it. So I'll try to aim it here. Now, the first thing, obviously, and this is a review, obviously, that by contrast to any other major world religion, and that's so important, the Jews consider themselves the chosen people. No other major world religion makes that claim. Not you look at Islam or the Buddhists, the Christians, Shinto, any of the other world religions, none of them claim that they are to be the chosen people, the people from whom the Messiah will come. And that therefore they set themselves apart. In Old Testament times, and if any of you were here this week, we had some wonderful studies in Old Testament prophets from Dwayne Addison, and I sort of got my Jewish taste buds going again, just listening to this stuff about all that. Well, anyway, no other religious or group makes that claim, and so therefore, in order to arrange their lives and their teachings so that the Messiah would come, they had to set themselves consciously and in every possible way apart from all the other religious groups in terms of religion, in terms of language, in terms of food, in terms of entertainment, child-rearing, everything like this, holy days, all these things. They set themselves apart from all the other groups and were, from the very beginning, militantly determined to hold on at the expense even of a great deal of violence. I'm always impressed when you read some of these Old Testament stories. Sometimes they'll go out and there'll be a battle, and then they're like 10,000 were slain, in one day, and it's no big deal. In the New Testament, you don't have any wars or people being slain, but every so often there's some Jewish king that goes off and fights some Babylonian or Assyrian warrior or something, and 10,000 people are gone. Let me give you an example. When I did my graduate work at Madison, we had sort of orator's corner where anybody who wanted to could get up on a soapbox and say what they wanted about this or that in front of the student union. And one student, I remember, got up and he was convincing. He said, "We cannot let young people read the Old Testament because it's nothing but sex and violence." And in a way, he had a very good point. I mean, you've got David there, which is about the most and then Solomon with his 500 wives and 500 concubines, wasn't it, and so on. And then you try to explain, I remember when I was teaching 7th grade Sunday school, Mr. Dorsted, what's a concubine? And, why does only the king get concubines? And that was kind of hard to explain because they were sort of, developing at that age, 7th, 8th grade and everything else, and they thought this Solomon was quite a guy. He could have 700 and, or 500, whatever it was. But the point was that they had to set themselves apart and be very militant from the very beginning. Okay. That leads to the second point here, and that creates, the other side of the coin, that creates anti-Semitism. From the very beginning, the Jews have been set apart, and there has been enormous persecution and hassling and all these things against the Jews from that time to the present. I think it's fair to say that in this country there has been some religious persecution against Catholics, against Mormons, and so on. I know they murdered Joseph Smith, and that's when they decided to leave for Utah, and to tie that in is what we said before. But basically no religious group has had anywhere near the persecution that the Jews have through anti-Semitism, and that just sort of didn't go away. Some of you might remember in 1988, even if he had any kind of chance to be president, Jesse Jackson blew it in 1988. He referred, to New York City as Heimetown. And that was the end of Jesse Jackson's campaign. I mean, it was that sort of remembrance of things. Or we've got the Nation of Islam with Louis Farrakhan today, and he thrives, you know, on the Jews being the enemy, and on having a common foe like that. Okay. And so what I'm trying to say is that no other religious group in this country has faced that. Now, what does that have to do with the old time versus the new time religion? The basic point here is when the persecution came and the hostility and all the rest of these things came, Jews had to make a decision. Should we, you know, stand pat where we are with the Orthodox, or should we make some kind of adjustments to the world in which we live? So eventually this becomes known as passing. Now, you know what I mean by passing? Where you pass, I mean, it's easier, you know, for a Jew to do this than for, say, a light-colored African-American. But the Jewish people, if they wanted to, could pass because they didn't have the skin problem that, say, an Oriental or a Native American or an African-American did. And the question became then, should we start to pass? Should we sort of get away from holding on to the high holy days and all the other things that were going on there simply in the name of holding on to the faith? And some did. And passing became, you know, very, very important. I'll give you one example. I was reading a biography of the founder of CBS. His name was William Paley. Very, very successful. He was born and raised in a very strict Jewish community. And what he decided, he knew he was talented. He saw the opportunities out there. And Paley started to pass. He minimized his Jewish roots and clearly went where he did because he felt he would never get to be, you know, president of a major institution like CBS if he had stayed loyal to the old traditional ways. So here was a neat conflict between, or a clear conflict anyway, between the old time and the new time religion. Passing was very important, okay, for them. And I'm going to get to a couple more instances where this happens. All right. Now, a third major theme besides the promised, the chosen people and anti-Semitism would be what we call the diaspora, or the dispersion of Jews around the world. There were those who argued from the very beginning that if you were to be a true, you know, and loyal Jew, you should stay in the Holy Land, or what was for a while called Palestine, and now obviously is what called Israel. But for all sorts of reasons, which we don't have time to go into here, you know, enormous numbers of Jewish people moved all around the world, everywhere, the diaspora, or the dispersion of these people everywhere. Many of them, for our purposes, settling in what we call today Poland in the 19th century. There was a huge collection of Jewish people. Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof would be a good example of that. That was set, you remember, in Poland. Okay. Anyway, they were there and they created a very strictly enforced Jewish community, and then the persecution started. The Russians then, as later, and still as the case, were very anti-Semitic. I mean, how many thousands of Jews have left, you know, Russia since World War II, just enormous numbers. But anyway, they were persecuted, and in order to survive, something like 3 million Jews emigrated out of Poland, and 90% of them came to this country. 90% starting in about 18-year background.
Right.
Yeah. And came to the Lower East Side.
Minnesota
eventually, but they stopped in New York.
You bet.
Yeah, right. And because they had to, that was their only haven.
Yep.
They couldn't get along with the Goyim or the Gentiles, right? That's not a bad word to say, isn't it? It's sort of a slangy word when you say Goyim instead of Gentiles.
It depends on the interpretation.
The interpretation, okay.
Yeah. In which time?
It's Yiddish.
It is Yiddish.
Yeah, Yiddish, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw Yiddish, I had enough German, so I saw there were some German connections here, but I didn't know the rest of it, and we had a little right across the street from...
Yiddish is a lot of German.
A lot of German, right, yeah. And Low German, right.
Yeah, Low German.
Right, and right across from Union Theological Seminary was a Jewish, you know, bookstore and a gift shop, and what's this stuff? And I grew up in a hurry, that's what I'm trying to say, seeing the world. Okay, so what happens... They come to New York, and for our purposes, here is where the real division starts. They came, and the one sort of haven, the one area of protection, of nourishment, whatever you want to call it, would be, you know, the local synagogue. The rabbi, the community that was there. They had no skills in surviving in an urban environment. They were farmers. Remember Tevye? What is he? Dairy, wasn't it? Tevye had a milk route or something. As an example. Was it vegetables? Okay. So anyway, you get the idea. And so they had to hold together, and they settled basically in the Lower East Side, and that's still a very strong Jewish, you know, community today. There are other places like the Upper West Side too, but basically here is what happened. And in order to get along, they would have to come to terms with how far should we go in protecting the old time religion and how far should we go in accommodating ourselves to the new time religion. Because, and I want to put in a plug here, it's one of the best books I've ever read and I recommend it strongly. It's Kim Potok's The Chosen. And I would recommend this, and he's written many books. He's a professor of philosophy at, I think he's retired now, at Pennsylvania, and he's a rabbi. He's written, My Name is Asher Lev, and he's written, this is a wonderful book, and it portrays the picture in fiction much better than I could ever do here in my language on this. What to do with the next generation who didn't know the persecution back in Poland, who didn't know how difficult it was, and who see the opportunities for getting ahead, who are bored or felt stifled or restricted in living in very poor, oftentimes very poor, and unhospitable conditions in that area, and see, you know, the whole world awaiting them. And there's Danny Saunders, for instance, who's very bright and decides the only way he can get out from the stifling of the old time religion is to, you know, sort of literally go uptown. And he goes to Columbia and finds Freud, he finds Marx, he finds Darwin, he finds a whole world there that he never knew existed before, and it to him was a very liberating kind of experience. And he learns how to pass. And then what happens, and I talked a little bit about this before with many of these, is that the workings of what we call Hansen's law comes in. Marcus Lee Hansen was a historian at Illinois, and he postulated a law. The third generation tries to remember what the second generation tried to forget. And the second generation, this is true in so many areas, tried to forget, you know, the old time religion back in the ghettos in the Lower East Side, and reached out and saw that education was the royal road, obviously, to what they would call freedom. I had a teacher when I was at Harvard, Oscar Handlin, a very interesting fellow, and he had grown up in the Lower East Side, and to him, religious freedom meant freedom not to be a Jew any longer, because he remembered all the things that were he considered to be so repressive. I wasn't ready for that particular, you know, kind of idea, but he became secular Jew simply because of what he had found before. So the old-time religion has real difficulty in holding on. Okay, let's see. Yeah, we're doing fine on time. So what am I getting at here? The diaspora opens up possibilities for Jews which they wouldn't have had back in Poland, where they wouldn't have had in some other very tightly organized, you know, area. And some held on very strictly. You get Yeshiva University, which is still going and flourishing in Manhattan and other places like this. But you also have the beginnings of real inroads of what we would call a more worldly, a more secular, a more, quote, intellectual kind of approach to this. And you have, starting in this country, more than in any other Jewish area in the world, you have the real beginnings of this three-way split between Reformed, Orthodox, and conservative. And there is no way in which anybody can sort of stop what the others are doing. They didn't have, for instance, the disciplinary power that you would have in the Catholic Church. You know, for a long time, if you weren't in good favor with the local bishop or the archbishop or whatever it was, they could simply excommunicate you, or they could withhold the sacraments for you, or something else like this. Not so in the Jewish church, the Jewish community. You simply had the kind of freedom to, you know, go and experiment and find, you know, or remake your own life for itself. And what they found was that through education, many of them, by contrast to the old ways, had soon became very, very successful. And in New York City, for instance, it's fair to say even today, there are two or three areas which are still dominated by those who had found their sort of liberation from the old-time religion. And that would be in law, and it would be in medicine, and it would be in entertainment. These areas still have a very strong element, mostly Reform, that's true, but still a very strong element of by now the third or fourth generation who found their way out of the old-time religion. And what sort of new-time religion they had was that of basically of the Reformed Church. Okay, so we've got the diaspora, we've got them coming to this country, and then you have the militants trying to hold on, and you have the new ones not any longer, like my teacher Oscar Handlin, simply no longer able to live with that sort of thing, and here he was, you know, he grew up in a very poor Jewish part of Brooklyn, and suddenly he's a full professor at Harvard. You can't go any higher than that. and Hamblin's very successful in what he's done, and to him that was more important, to be a great writer and a teacher. And well, he wasn't a great teacher, I shouldn't say that, he was a terrible teacher, but he could do a good seminar. I don't want to get off on sidetracked on that sort of thing, but he was to me sort of a very good example of what I was interested in, that sort of thing. Okay, so what happens then, so you've got chosen people, you've got anti-Semitism, you've got the diaspora, and the fourth element that sets the Jewish people apart and really is the decisive factor, and I think old time versus new time religion, would be of course the Holocaust. The Holocaust comes obviously in World War II. There were obviously many clear signs that it was going to come in the 1930s and in Germany, and then it all came in the 1940s. Okay, so I'm not talking about it in any great detail, I'm not minimizing it as one of the greatest disasters and catastrophes in all of human history. And if you have the chance, have any of you been at the Holocaust Museum in Washington? Yeah, and I think it's fair to say if you go, don't plan to do anything much afterwards. I mean, don't plan to have a big time at a nice restaurant or something else. It's like going to the Vietnam Memorial. I mean, it's just such a wiping out kind of experience that you're just sort of numbed. But it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary, I think, to do that. So it's right on the mall, you know, in Washington, between the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial and so on. I'd like to see the new Roosevelt. Have you seen the Roosevelt? Were you there lately? You saw the Roosevelt?
Yeah, this was like 6 months ago.
Yeah, that'd be the Roosevelt. I'd like to see that one very much. Yeah. And so get there. You know, okay, anyway, the Holocaust. How could the God who had promised to be reincarnated through the chosen one, the Messiah, allow this to happen? It divided the Jewish community in a way which nothing else could. They had to come to terms with this. This was the God of Isaac and Abraham and all the things that are connected with this. The rich tradition going down over the centuries and going right up into the 1920s and the 1930s and all this. Suddenly, they would have to make a decision on this, and it divided the Jewish community because there were those who argued we can simply no longer believe in in Jehovah or the God of the Old Testament, and simply left. And others say the one thing we have left, obviously in our lives, with this incredible, disaster of 6 million people lost, the one thing we have left is our faith, and therefore we have to hold on to it. So the old versus the new comes very clearly into focus there. And that happens at about the time that the other changes in American religious life, which I talked about earlier when we started, got going also. The final one, of course, would be the creation of the political state of Israel, 1948. This solved some problems, and Lord knows, I mean that it opened a lot of others. So very difficult, okay. There had been since about the middle of the 19th century a significant number of artisans and farmers and other Jewish people who, not wanting to put up with the persecution and the hostility and all the rest, had slowly but steadily in numbers moved into what was then known as Palestine. Well, actually, the term Palestine gets started right after World War I, when Turkey didn't want it any longer and gave it to England. And there were a significant number of Jewish people, mostly very dedicated to their religious faith, who moved back and started to talk about the idea that maybe what we could do was reconstitute a haven, a political state, where all Jews all around the world could come and be safe, and not be subject to the persecution that they had known in this country, in Poland, in Germany, goodness knows, and all the rest of these places. And their numbers increased rather significantly during the 1920s and the 1930s, to where there were a substantial number. And already, at the point I'm trying to make here, is that with their exclusiveness, with their being set apart and all the rest, they came into very sharp conflict over a lot of issues: education, housing, law enforcement, all these things, with the Arab communities there. Because they had been in small numbers before, now suddenly they were becoming, just to survive, they were becoming much more assertive, aggressive, if you want to call it that, and therefore had to come band together and hold on to the old ways if they were going to survive as a people, not individuals, but survive as a people. Okay. Then comes World War II with all the disasters that are created there, and the solution for, you know, the Jews certainly weren't welcome in Germany, they weren't welcome in Russia, they had been, there had been religious persecution in Russia far more than in Germany. That's not, that maybe I think that's fair to say. All of them, Trotsky, there's so many. And so therefore the idea grew in the Jewish communities that maybe we could get a permanent haven for our people once and for all, and build a community which could be so developed that it would be open, it would be ready, it would be prepared for the coming, you know, of the chosen one. And all sorts of political agitation went on back and forth. The United States got involved with the Israeli cause on this, and in 1948, Israel as a political state was created. Okay, that comes to no one, is no news to any of you, but it's important in 1948 under the auspices of the United Nations, and also very clearly, and it's just as important today as that in that time, under the auspices of the United States. If the United States hadn't been there with its protection and its support and the Jewish community that we had in this country, obviously Israel never would have made it. All right. From the beginning, what's interesting here is that the new Israel found one other point. It had also, the creation of Israel had the strong, interesting thing, it had the strong support of the American evangelical community, because they were, you know, they take a very literal interpretation of the scripture, and there's one prophecy that says that Jehovah, or the chosen one, the Messiah, will come back once the Jews have returned to their homeland. That's important. And what they took the creation of Israel as a political state to mean was that God was really responsible for it. It wasn't the UN or Harry Truman or anybody else, but it was really God who was responsible, and therefore they cheered on the support of Israel, the creation of the state of Israel. And you had American support not only from the Jewish community for Israel, but you had it from the evangelical community. That's very important. And you had, for instance, who was it, Begin, when he was a prime minister, he would call up Jerry Falwell as his chief aide and a sort of explainer of what was going on in American religion. A lot of people thought that was rather strange, but if you were, you know, a devout Jew, you would not think this is strange at all, because your best friends were not the liberals or not the others, but they were the evangelicals. Okay, you get the idea. So what happens is that Israel found itself in, you know, disastrous conditions right from the very beginning, because within Israel itself, the debate started, which is still as alive today as in 1948, should we make Israel into a religious state, not just a political state? Should Israel be under the direct control of, let's say, the Orthodox, and that all the rules and all the laws and everything, policies in Israel, should be subject to and dependent on, you know, the Torah, the Old Testament laws. So, and that we exist, that the Israel as a religious state should exist for that reason and that reason alone, and that the priests, in a very real sense here, and the rabbis, all the rest, these would be the people who would also be the political leaders, the leaders in all parts of the other community. But on the other hand, the old-time religion had faded enough in other parts of the world so that many of the Jews living in Israel, and certainly this was true in America also, saw Israel as a political state, not as a religious state. So there were enormous conflicts taking place within Israel, which I say are still going on today. And the other one, obviously, was that, you know, when the Jews came, the Arabs didn't bring out the welcome wagon, you know, for the Jewish population. You didn't come in with, you know, chicken soup, I suppose you could say, to use an old ethnic cliche here, or something else like this. You didn't get, remember when we moved into Scottsdale, well, there, the welcome wagon was there the next day, and I got free grease jobs and free haircut and all these things. The welcome wagon was there. Obviously, Israel blew up into violence, and the way in which it survived, obviously, was to develop the very best military prowess, that's the only word for it, that one could have, and they did it because they got the support of the United States. Boeing and Lockheed and all the rest don't exist in Israel, but they do exist, you know, fairly close around here. And the United States support really made a difference, and that worked out this very unique kind of relationship. Okay. With this. So the fifth step would be, you know, the creation of the State of Israel. And from that point to the present, the old-time religion is in one sense alive, but still very much under sharp scrutiny in Israel. And it came up in a very serious way just I think it's now about 6 months ago with Netanyahu, because there are two major political problems. I don't want to get into parties. I don't want to get into too much detail. But there are two basic political parties in this country. Neither has an absolute, in Israel, neither has an absolute majority. And so what they need to have a majority is to have the support of many of these, at least some of these little fringe groups, who may have in the Knesset or their legislature, who may have 1 or 2 or 3% of the vote. But what happened, with the Labour Party, then what happened with the others, was that they had to bring in the support of these people. All right. When Netanyahu then wanted to have enough support so he'd have a majority in the legislature, he had to cut a deal with some of the ultra-Orthodox groups. And they insisted, and this was changed later, but this shows the old-time, new-time religion thing here, they insisted that their group, and only their group, should be allowed to set up the formal religious ways in which could become, an Orthodox Jew. They were to be in charge of all what we would call the, if you want to call it that way, the evangelism programs, in the Israeli society. So if you wanted, say you came in from Russia or wherever it was, and wanted to convert, say you were a secular Jew, and you wanted to convert, you would have to go through the training, the education, that the Orthodox were in charge of. They wanted to have all new settlers be Orthodox. They didn't want the liberals, they didn't want the conservatives or the reform people. And Netanyahu gave in and he said yes. And this only exacerbated the problems that much more with the other relationships. And if Israel didn't, what I'm saying is, if they didn't have enough trouble already with the Arabs, goodness knows, they suddenly now they face these enormous problems which they're having here. And these are the ones that are still taking place. I'm talking too much. You've got questions so far? With this? Okay. So it really, then it becomes a matter of how do you keep your support, from your friends. If you're, say, Netanyahu or Perez or any of the other earlier prime ministers, how do you keep your support from your friends from overseas? Because you have to have this to go in. I want to tell just one story here, which is, I think, absolutely fascinating. We have at our school, we have what we call term in the Middle East. And we send one teacher and then about usually 20, 25 students over, and they study in Jerusalem. They travel around and look at different things, but they basically study, the Jewish religion and Hebrew and basic secular history and all the rest. And almost all of them go over ahead of time very pro-Jewish or very pro-Israel for all kinds of reasons. They think this is the case. But when they get over there, they see a whole different situation, and almost all of them come back, pro-Arab. It's an amazing sort of thing because they see the desperate plight, that's the only word, of the Palestinians. Because if there ever was, maybe there is no solution, but if there ever was a total failure, it is what the Israeli government has done or hasn't done, with the Palestinians. They are simply there and there's simply nothing for them to do or to go and everything else. And so some of them, get involved in, militancy as sort of the last way out, but nevertheless, this is the case. So comments or questions? I personally, to come back to the point I made at the beginning, I don't know how they can ever solve these problems. There's so much in place, and you're not dealing, as I say, just with oil or with coal or with markets. You're dealing with the will of God, and there's no compromise in politics. This is a problem of getting quote religion into politics. In politics, you need to find ways which will at least reasonably satisfy the interests of different groups. You work out compromises, but you can't compromise. You can't cut a deal with these. And then, of course, as Netanyahu tried to do, he sort of put himself out as being much tougher, on the Arabs than his his competitors were. So he was, he's had to live up to that sort of thing, and that, in a very real sense, has set back the peace process. But then, in the Arab community, you've got such incredible division and lack of control. Arafat is not my favorite personality, but he's got some enormous, problems to cope with. Maybe he hasn't done enough, but I don't know. But the old-time religion now is going to have a great deal of difficulty there. And what's to me is fascinating, just looking at it from overall perspective, is that it's the only one of the various groups we've taken up this week that has such a strong, connection with overseas sources. We don't worry in this country if we have a battle between Catholics and Protestants or something, that there's some difficulty with Rome or with something else like that, but that's the problem here. So it all gets down to, you know, nationalism, it all gets down to militancy, and, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have a comment or a question. I thought that you brought up reasonably well this fact that there is no one Judaism,
right,
or Judaism.
Right.
And I think it's always very necessary to remember that. We can't talk about Jews as one group.
Right, and I grew up thinking they were all the same, just like I grew up thinking all Catholics were exactly the same.
Right.
And
we make that mistake often. Now, one of the notions that you brought up here, and Potok's book also talks about this, is the chosen
right
idea. I have thought about it quite a bit, I'm sure we all have. And you refer to the fact that this has in fact caused a lot of anti-Semitism and hatred in other groups. And this is one of those very touchy issues that's very hard to talk about. But, you know, when you really look at the point, what some of the Orthodox Jews specifically often attempt to repeat is this, that, you know, God chose us. Mm-hmm. And it's a rather arrogant statement. I grew up in Finland. If I were to say to the Americans, you know, the Finnish people are God's favorite people, I'm not sure how favorably I would be looked at.
Not even at, no, I'm just joking. In Finland, maybe you would be, but...
Well, yeah, no, of course, in Finland.
That's just a joke.
Or you as a Norwegian,
Norway, oh, my,
say,
yes, right.
Well, God chose Norway.
Yeah, right, he's alive and well in Oslo, right, yeah.
And when you really look at the origin of this sort of notion that there is one people who start to call themselves as the chosen people, it's rather amazing.
Well, they would
say,
not
really a question, it's a thought. Yeah.
Well, they would say, look at the Old Testament. We didn't choose ourselves. God chose us. So there were
no, there's an old rabbinical story that tells that Yahweh went around and he negotiated with different nations.
Okay.
And asked, you know, would you guys like to be my favorite nation? Would you like to be? And everyone else refused, but the Israelites. And so they were the smart ones who actually knew to say yes.
Well, look at all the trouble it got them into. Whoever it hears, we don't worry about the Assyrians any longer or the Babylonians or anything else like that. So they're gone, you know, but look at the, you know, in a sense, I'm half serious about this, the responsibilities the Jewish people took on themselves by, you know, by accepting this. But they would say they had no choice in the matter. I mean,
they would say exactly the opposite. They would say that they were the ones who actually chose to accept the offer. This is the Orthodox Jewish tradition in the Talmud.
Okay. That makes me feel better, because I always thought that, you know, Yahweh took the initiative, and when...
Well, Yahweh did. Yahweh went around and asked, would you like to be my favorite nation? And they said yes.
Wow.
Whereas the others said no.
Oh my!
I guess Yahweh also asked the Americans what you like.
Well, there are some who still think they are. You know, God loves America best, right? Kind of thing. Yeah, please.
I have a pretty clear idea about the Orthodox, what their convictions are, and so on.
But I didn't get to that.
Between the conservative and the reformed.
The reformed would be basically those who see religion as a cultural matter, in terms of food, literature, music, but nothing really, in a sense, binding the way the Torah or the Ten Commandments are. And they're very much in the world, so to speak, and say Judaism is a living religion, therefore we have to come to terms with it. They have no problem ordaining women, you know, as rabbis. This is something else. They are much more open to what we would call ecumenical kind of relations. And of course, what's happening there is, it's, you know, who knows what's happening, but the biggest problem facing the Jews in this country, I should have mentioned this before, is intermarriage. Right now, of all the Jewish young people who are single, or I'm sorry, who have just gotten married, 52% drop out of their Jewish connections. 52% of all the young people just married, 52% drop out. And that's not showing any signs of changing. The Orthodox, or, you know, like Mormons, they marry and intermarry within themselves and they keep going. But the Reform have moved out to where there are projections that by the year about 2020, there probably won't be, you know, even a million Jews in this country left. as this. Now, the conservatives are what we would call the center group, because they're somewhat center between the rest. They hold on more to kosher, they hold on more to sending their children to yeshiva or to the, you know, to their schools. They're more supportive of Israel, for instance. They keep the high holy days, but they also put a great deal of emphasis, more than the others, in the sort of the autonomy of each local, you know, congregation. There, more than anything else, and here is where there's diversity, even within these three groups, so much of the success or failure of any congregation depends on the personality, of the charisma, if you like, of the rabbi. These are the ones that, remember about, what was it, about 7-8 years ago in Brooklyn, there was one, he was 92 years old, he was the one of the Lubavitch, and they actually thought he was the Messiah, and he attracted an enormous amount of attention. If you read the Chosen, you remember how much power Danny's father had in his, you know, with his little flock, and we would call the conservatives, or the moderates, put emphasis basically on the autonomy of the congregation. I use the ordination of women as a good example. If the congregation wants to ordain women, fine. If it doesn't, they have the right to do so. Orthodox would say under no conditions. In fact, even now, of course, when Orthodox have their worship, the men and the women sit in separate sections, and you know, all the rest of these things. Women don't get bar mitzvah and all these things. And the reforms say, you know, this isn't an issue for us. If a woman want to get ordained, that's up to the individual woman in the, you know, to make the decision. So the conservatives are somewhat in between. And for some, this is important because they don't want to sort of give up the loyalty to the old ways. They think of Holocaust and they think of the anti-Semitism, and they know there's a common enemy out there. And so they think that it behooves them to hold on to some degree to you know, older traditional ways, old-time religion, but not to the extent to which the Orthodox do. You know, they keep kosher at home maybe, but then they have no problem eating out with Gentiles and so on. Is that basically those would be the three areas? And then also I have to come down strongly on this, and Potok understands this so well, on how important all the local, you know, situation is for each one of these things, depending on how effective the rabbi is, because that comes out of the old tradition where the rabbi was the only one who had any education at all. And therefore, the rabbi had an insight into these things. And if you know Talmud, all the, you know, what is it, 670 some laws that you find in the Talmud, only the rabbi understood this. And so the rabbi was the one who explained this to all the people. And so that's the only way they had of knowing what was going on. And so therefore, the rabbi held sway in this area, but another rabbi might, you know, somewhere else hold sway. This is a pattern in other groups, you know, in the Amish, for instance, in this country, very strong local autonomy. It really, you know, the way you express your Amishness, if you put it that way, is where you live. Not so much that there's an overall Amishness that's expected of all people. And the length of men's beards, for instance, that's always an interesting, or the size of your hat band, or something else. This is like in Norway, where you have your own particular unique, you know, costume on the basis of the valley you live in. I don't know if they do this in Finland, yeah. Right, where the women have, I love them. The valleys, right, and so on. I'm from the Dal, or the Stad, I should say, the city. I'm from the Stad of Jor, that's how I got my name. And so on. And this is true also with the Jewish community. And some hold on to the old-time religion because that's what the rabbi says. And some hold on to the new. But if anything broke down, as some of you who've been with me all week have broken down, it's this idea of the authority of the clergy, by contrast to where it had been even 30, 40 years ago. Does that, yeah.
Some, but like the Reformed, then basically they're are not concerned about kosher.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And,
they can if they want to be.
What about the rabbi, the calf?
That would be Orthodox. That would be Orthodox, right?
That's strictly.
That's Orthodox because that's Old Testament, and they don't.
Or Reformed, yeah. Wear the calf.
They don't. They don't debate it. They don't have adult forums. You know, here the rabbi speaks, and that's it. Whereas in Reform, if you ever had, I did a lot of stuff with moral majority and these things, and I've talked to some of the Reform groups up in the Twin Cities, and wow, they argue all the time, you know, about everything. And the rabbi is sort of an intermediary, I guess you could say, or a facilitator on this. And I remember, we have to go, but the best question they always ask me, and I enjoyed talking immensely there, the only question, what do you see in this Jesus guy that's so good? And I remember that really struck home to me. I had to think about that, you know, for a long time. I'd never been asked that question in my life. And they weren't satisfied with, you know, with slick answers. because they love to debate, very competitive, very aggressive, and they take this for granted. Back in Minnesota, we call this being Minnesota nice. I don't know if you know that thing. Everybody's polite and kind and generous, and you all smile at each other. Not the Jewish population. I've had Jewish people, you know, my elder house. After, you know, I always call for discussion. After 10 minutes, Monday, you know, some Jewish lawyer said, "How can you say that?" You know, and off we went. And that was a whole different world. And that depends on, you know, their extent of training with their local rabbi. I'll be glad to talk about this otherwise, but people are later. But people are moving, and we don't want to miss Vespers. So I'll close off here for the tape ministry. Okay.